I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. It's our weekly international briefing. We'll have a report on elections in Grenada. The trend to throwing out incumbents continues. And while Americans may not be ready to tune in, the rest of the world is already getting ready for World Cup. We'll get a report on how the preliminaries are going so far. But first, the G8 Summit. That's the annual gathering of the leaders of the world's leading international nations, industrial nations, rather. It wrapped up in Japan yesterday. And while climate change grabbed the headlines, the leaders also talked about the challenges facing African nations. Joining us to talk about the G8 conference is NPR's Anthony Kuhn. He covered it. Also with us is Constance Ikoku. She's the Washington Bureau Chief for Nigeria's This Day newspaper. Welcome to you both. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Constance, I'm going to start with you. Seven African leaders traveled to meet the Group of Eight, which is supposed to be the world's leading industrial economies. Among them were Nigeria and South Africa. Why did they go?
Well, it's been a practice for some years for the G8 leaders to invite some African countries, because if you're going to be discussing about issues that concern the continent, I think that it makes sense to invite leaders from that nation, from that continent, to give them a sense of belonging and put them on the table. If you're going to talk about aid, if you're going to talk about trade, if you're going to talk about health issues, you know, it makes sense to have them and have discussions with them.
Anthony, the G8 focused on Africa 3 years ago when they met in Scotland. Isn't that right?
That's right. At the Glen Eagles G8 in 2005, then Prime Minister Tony Blair made it a point of focusing on Africa and climate change, and it's been very important since then. But as Constance points out, African leaders have been attending for several years. And it's, you know, they've got a number of platforms going that this fits in with, the UN's Millennium Development Goals and other platforms. And the G8 itself has tried to put in some institutions to deal with the Africa issues, such as coming up with an Africa Action Plan and things like that. So they're trying to establish a framework for working with aid to Africa.
Did they come out with any specific commitments in this summit?
They were pretty vague on commitments. Essentially, they just restated what was said last year in Germany, in Heiligendamm, Germany, which again, very much restated what was said in Glen Eagles in 2005. There was a lot of talk of, goals, economic goals, such as improving business environment, all these sort of things, but very little mention of where the money was going to come from for these things. And campaigners were very concerned that there would be backslipping. There is already indication that they're going to have great difficulty in meeting the goals set out in Glen Eagles for overseas development aid and aid to Africa.
A private group, Data, a group founded by the singer and music singer Bono and the music producer Bob Geldof, says that the G8 has only just delivered about $3 billion of the $25 billion pledged in 2005. Anthony, was that talked about at the conference?
That was a focus of the groups, of a lot of the campaigners and a lot of the African leaders attending. At Glen Eagles in 2005, they promised to double aid to Africa, double ODA, overseas development aid, to $50 billion by 2010. $25 billion were supposed to go to Africa. Now people are saying they're going to come up $30 billion short of that $50 billion goal, and that shortfall could cost 5 million people their lives. Even more telling, way back in the 1970s, they promised that they would increase the amount of money that goes to overseas development aid to 0.7%, 0.7% of gross national income. And they have not reached that. And to paraphrase Nelson Mandela, 35 years is a long time to wait for less than 1%.
Constance, how? First of all, I get the impression that sometimes what the G8 want to talk about and what they want to do doesn't always match up with what the African countries want them to do. Was that the case here?
Yeah, you're very correct. We've written about this story, And what our country, Nigeria, for instance, has been saying is that we don't want African leaders to go to the G8 summit and it becomes a photo op and another talk shop. You know, we want them to make serious compromises on issues, for instance, the Doha round of negotiations, which hangs in the balance, has been stalled for several years, you know.
You mean trade talks?
Yeah, trade talks. The future to Africa, you know, the critical steps that need to be taken is in the area of trade and investment. Aid is okay, but in the long run, aid is not sustaining, you know. So when you have issues of trade, it's very, very important, you know. And that's why, you know, in Nigeria, for instance, people are taking their government to task, you know. Put pressure on these countries to make the necessary compromises that they need to make. If they really profess that they want development in Africa, they should begin to make bold decisions. They should begin to make painful decisions that are critical to the future of the continent. You know, so that's what we want, and not just another talk show.
So basically, they want trade barriers lowered so they can develop their own economies. They really aren't as interested in direct aid.
Correct. You know. One of the issues in the Doha round of negotiations is improved access to market, you know, to African farmers, you know, strong rules that would prevent trade distorting behavior. We've talked several years about subsidies in developed countries, subsidies to their farmers, and the way that it hurts African farmers. These are issues that are very, very important, you know. But when they come to the table, developed countries don't want to make the necessary compromises that they need to make. At the end of the day, you gather in the G8, you make promises on aid, and I tell you, aid is not the salvation to Africa. They need to begin to talk about investment in critical infrastructure that will power the economy, and that's what we're interested in.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking about the G8 summit with NPR's Anthony Kuhn and with Constance Okoku of This Day newspaper from Nigeria. Anthony, what about food? The high price of food has been a major challenge, particularly for some of the developing economies. Was this discussed?
People were a bit disappointed about the lack of emphasis on rising food prices at the G8 talks this year. There was a lot of talk on health and education. There was a lot of talk about financial things, but there was not a lot of talk on how people are going to cope with the rises in food prices. And as we know, for poor people, when food prices rise like that, it erases gains that have been made in poverty eradication, and it forces people to choose between eating and sending their kids to school or seeking medical attention. Mm-hmm. Also, another thing that was very disturbing was that there was very little talk about the issue of biofuels, the fact that people are putting grains that should go to food into their cars. And many people say that that the developed nations are covering up the fact that the U.S. Use of corn for ethanol has driven up the food prices, grain prices, by 75%. There was a leaked World Bank report that said that, and it wasn't published, some people say, to save the U.S. from embarrassment.
That was my question, and just briefly, because I want to move on to one more topic before we let you go. But why wasn't it discussed? It's such an obvious crisis, and these are all producing nations, and why wasn't it talked about? In fact, some of these countries are also experiencing some negative sort of domestic political effects from world food prices. Is it because they don't want to talk about something when they can't come to a conclusion that they can and then advertise? They don't want to raise it if they feel like they're not going to make progress?
Well, I feel, you know, what came out of this whole G8 thing, the documents that came out of it, were so watered down, and they, you know, these negotiations all inevitably go for the absolute lowest common denominator, the sort of language that will offend the fewest people and deliver the fewest concrete promises. So that's one thing, and you know, there was a lot of debate among these different parties that made it hard to get a consensus. But it just seems like this sort of thing isn't a priority when you can't even agree on getting foreign development aid up to 0.7%. You know it's not because of money. It's because of a lack of political will. That's the problem, I think.
Okay, finally, Constance, I wanted to ask you about the statement that the G8 delivered on the political crisis in Zimbabwe. Of course, you know, we've been covering this closely. The longtime President, Robert Mugabe, was sworn in recently for his sixth term after an election that was widely seen as as stolen and conducted with violence and intimidation directed at the opposition. How was this declaration received by the African countries in attendance? I sense that there was disagreement about the utility of that kind of declaration. They were also asking for additional sanctions against Mr. Mugabe's regime, particularly the top government leaders.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of discussion within African countries or among African countries concerning Zimbabwe. And I think that the negotiations will continue. I think that South Africa will continue to play a critical role. Nigeria would play a critical role. And
Nigeria support additional sanctions, or are they also against it?
Well, the Nigerian government has not been categorical concerning sanctions, but it has tried to weigh in on the issue in Zimbabwe, and it has tried to speak to President Mugabe and ask him to come to the negotiating table with the opposition.
How was this declaration received, though, particularly by your readers? Do they welcome it as a sign that the West is holding him accountable for poor governance, or do they see it as kind of interference and racist meddling, which is what Mugabe's spokesman called it?
Opinions are highly divided, you know, and this is a very emotional issue. There are people that think that the African Union or African countries individually can play a very big role in ending the crisis in Zimbabwe. There are people that think that Western nations are meddling too much in the internal affairs of a sovereign country. So, you know, there are people on two divides. You know, everybody is entitled to their own opinion. But the most important issue is that we have to come to the negotiating table and see how we end the crisis in Zimbabwe.
Constance Ikoku is the Washington Bureau Chief for This Day newspaper from Nigeria. She joined us here in our Washington studios. We were also joined by NPR's Anthony Kuhn. He's been reporting on the G8 summit, and he joined us by phone from Sapporo, Japan. I thank you both so much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jill.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. A little later in the program, soccer's World Cup. The games are in 2010, but soccer fans around the world are already glued to their TV sets. Why? We'll find out. But first, Grenada's Tillman Thomas was sworn in yesterday as prime minister. His National Democratic Congress led the opposition for 13 years until it won the general election earlier this week. Grenada is not alone in choosing new leadership. Change has occurred across the region this year and last. Here to tell us more about this and developments from the recent meeting of the Caribbean Community, or CARICOM, is Jackie Charles of the Miami Herald. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Talk to me about the election in Grenada. There have been several elections in which there have been changes, and some people are surprised by this. The Prime Minister of Jamaica turned out. I think Trinidad and Tobago is the only place that's held election this year in which the party in power held on. Why is that? Is there a trend that you see?
Well, yes, definitely. We're seeing a trend in the Caribbean region, and some would even argue if you look at Trinidad and Tobago's elections just a couple of months ago during the latter half of last year, that you had a situation where you had a third party. The opposition was split. When you look at the popular vote, in fact, the opposition got more vote than the incumbent, but because of the Westminster system and how the votes are separated, the incumbent retained power. But clearly what's happening in the Caribbean region is what's happening here. People are seeing a rise in prices, experiencing high fuel electricity bills, and there seems to be this wind of change or this need for change. The interesting trend in many of these cases where we've seen these leaders go to the polls is that they were seeking an unprecedented fourth term, fifth term, third term in office, and the population is saying, no, it's time to bring someone else in.
Were there any specific issues on the table, or is it more the whole question of we need a change?
Actually, in each of these cases, when I followed these elections and just listening to what the voters were saying, talking to some of the experts, talking to folks on the ground, the one thing that kept coming up over and over was the rise in prices, you know, the rise in their standard of living. Because think about it, if you're in the Caribbean, in all of these countries, there's a high importation bill. So you are already paying more than the average American. And so now, if you're in a case like Grenada, where there's double-digit unemployment, where just a few years ago, your island was almost flattened by a hurricane, you're like, something needs to happen. Something needs to change. And so by going in, voting out the incumbent, voting in the opposition, what many of these individuals feel is that they're going to see a change in their social and economic living conditions. Now, that's to be seen.
Talk to me about the summit of the Caribbean heads of state, which you attended recently, the CARICOM. First of all, what is this group about and what do they talk about?
Well, the whole deal with it's called the Caribbean Community or CARICOM. It's 15 nations, mostly English speaking, with the addition of Haiti and Suriname. They're the two non-English speaking countries that are part of this coalition. And what they're seeking to do, their big goal is almost to recreate an economic a European Union model in the region. So it's about political, but more so economic integration, a single market and economy where you can have the free movement of people from island to island that are part of this relationship. And what they're saying is that in this global context today, as small island states, we can't do it alone. We need to do it together. And they represent 14 out of 15 votes, because you have a situation where Montserrat, which is still part of the British, is also a member. But in a forum like the United Nations, if you are a country like Venezuela and you're trying to, you know, get to the Security Council, that's 14 votes. That's a block. And what they have demonstrated through the years is that they vote as a block. So right now for them, though, the question that a lot of people in the region, they're asking beyond that, what is the relevancy of CARICOM? How effective can CARICOM be? When we come together as in Antigua last week, and they've decided that they are going to launch a $60 million tourism campaign, where we're now going to market the Caribbean region as one. It's not just going to be come to Jamaica, come to the Bahamas, it's going to be come to the Caribbean. So it's $60 million. Can these countries shore up? Can they put the money out there? And are they going to be a unified front? That is the question that we're asking, and that's what everyone is waiting to see, because this movement has been around now for 35 years, at least. They just celebrated their 35th anniversary while in Antigua. And so with some, even among the ranks, we're saying that we need to stop acting like a community of sovereign states, and we need to act more as a unified front.
I understand that the crime was also on the agenda at CARICOM. Why is that?
Well, it's interesting. Today in our newspaper, the Miami Herald, we have a story about the number of deportations being up. And a number of these countries are blaming the spike in crime on the increase in deportations, especially from the United States, although the U.S. government disagrees with that assessment. But we are seeing a trend, a spike in crime. And it's not just about crime, but the kinds of crime, you know, drive-by, things that just did not take place in the Caribbean region. You're looking at a oil-rich country like Trinidad and Tobago right now is struggling with this crime issue. Usually when you thought about crime, you know, there would be other countries. You know, Jamaica has been notorious for years with a very high crime rate. But what we're also seeing, even in a little tiny island like Antigua and Barbuda, they are also wrestling with this issue of crime. And in fact, what you're also seeing, though, is a response, a creative response. They are looking to Scotland Yard. They're looking to Canada. They're even looking to the United States, bringing in experts, bringing in retired police officers. In the case of Antigua and Barbuda, there's a retired Canadian police officer who now heads that police force, while in Jamaica and Trinidad, they have retired Scotland Yard officers who are providing support, and they are now members of that police force.
We've also been tracking the tense relationship between the Dominican Republic and the Haitians who live there. Can you just tell us a little bit more about that? What's the backstory here? And is this the kind of issue that gets discussed at CARICOM?
Well, you know, the backstory is that Haiti once owned the Dominican Republic, and that the Dominican Republic celebrates its independence from Haiti and not Spain. point. And that is a relationship that goes back, you know, years and years. And so what you have is a situation where I don't like you, but you're my neighbor, and somehow it's a mutually beneficial relationship. You've got this border between the two countries. It's a porous border. Haitians are used as laborers. They're working in areas called the Bataille, or these like the sugar plantations. But then you have this whole issue with race that's underlining, where now you're seeing reports, as Amnesty International reported, that Dominicans who are dark-skinned are being deported to Haiti because the belief is that they're Haitians and not Dominicans. At the same time, you have children of Haitian immigrants in the Dominican Republic who were born in the Dominican Republic, and they have no access to a birth certificate. Nothing just says that I'm Dominican. In fact, they aren't even regarded as Dominican.
So even though they're born there, they're not entitled to full citizenship rights.
They're not entitled to full citizenship.
That must be a very tense issue between these two countries.
Well, it is. But at the same time, Haiti argues that any child born of Haitian parentage, because the situation just doesn't exist in the Dominican Republic, but the Bahamas also has the same rule. You know, when you're 18, they allow you to apply for citizenship if your mother is not Bahamian. But in terms of the DR, it's, you know, you're born of Haitian parentage, you're born here. That doesn't mean that you're a Dominican. But what Haiti says is, if you're Haitian, go to a Haitian consulate, go to a Haitian embassy, provide proof that both of your parents are Haitian or that you're born of Haitian lineage, and you are entitled to Haitian citizenship. But, you know, that the argument has been there is that these are children, they speak Spanish, they don't speak Creole, they have been brought up in that Dominican environment, they're more Dominican than Haitian, and that they should be entitled to citizenship.
That's very interesting. Jackie Charles of the Miami Herald was kind enough to join us from member station WLRN in Miami. Jackie, thanks so much for that update.
Thank you.
It's got megastars, fanatical fans, national pride at stake. And every 4 years, it garners one of the largest gatherings of athletes in the world. No, we are not talking about the Olympic Games, but World Cup. And even though the tournament doesn't take place until the year 2010, qualifying matches are already underway. The fervor is already in overdrive. Here to tell us more is Franklin Foer. He's the author of How Soccer Explains the World, An Unlikely Theory of Globalization. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
Why do the qualifying rounds start so early?
Well, people, first of all, it's a whittling down of all the nations, all the soccer-playing nations in the world to the 32 teams that will take place, that will take part in the World Cup in South Africa. So there are a lot of countries that need to be whittled out. And so at this stage in the qualifications, you've got a lot of the minnows of world soccer kind of getting knocked out. So the United States just competed against Barbados in two games, which eliminated Barbados from the competition. And then we move into each continent, each soccer federation has its own different system for qualifying for the cup. And so we're moving through these kind of long, elaborate qualification procedures to whittle down the teams to the 32 that'll go to South Africa in 2010.
So each region is in a different stage of the qualifying rounds right now.
Exactly. So in South America, they've already played six games of qualification. And Europe is about to go into another big bout of qualification matches in August.
Can you just... do you need an advanced degree to understand how the process works? Like, who plays whom? How do you qualify? How many rounds? I mean, do I have to go back to school for this?
Yeah, no, exactly. It's all based on it's a totally unrationalized process that grows out of the different political alignments in each of the various soccer federations around the world, and it's definitely not a rational system, and it requires almost fanatical devotion to figure out what the heck is going on.
Okay, I feel better. I feel a little better. Now, the World Cup, like the Olympics, is very much tied in with kind of national pride.
Yeah.
But increasingly, don't players move around the world? Do
yeah? So we just watched the European Championships that was played in Switzerland and Austria over the course of the month of June, and it's really one of the It's one of the biggest sporting events of the decade. It happens it happens every 4 years. It was a really interesting tournament because you had all these European teams, but almost every European team had a player from Brazil on his team. So you had a Brazilian midfielder in Turkey playing for Turkey, for Portugal, for some of the Eastern European countries. It's kind of an unsettling thing to see. And then you have coaches who don't come from the countries that they're coaching. So Russia, which advanced really far in the tournament, was coached by a Dutchman. Portugal was coached by a Brazilian. Greece was coached by a German. So you do have labor moves quite freely through this this soccer playing market. And nationalities, I mean, it's one of these amazing things. Nationalism is still hugely important in this event. People feel incredible passion for their national teams, but their national teams aren't necessarily composed of their countrymen. You have kind of mercenaries who come into these teams, who nationalize as citizens, you know, a week before the tournament to play for their teams. Yet the nationalism persists.
One of the other things that unfortunately seems to persist is racism, something that surfaced in the last sort of World Cup final when I think people remember that one of the French players was insulted by a player from another country and he headbutted him, and he later said that he had been, you know, grievously insulted in a manner that was intended to be particularly hurtful. Do you think that this kind of the globalization of the sport, the fact that the players are moving around the world and playing for teams that are very far away from the countries of their birth, will finally ameliorate that?
Well, first of all, just the narrative surrounding the headbutt is incredibly complicated. It's been the subject already of documentaries and doctoral dissertations and the like. FIFA and which is the body that governs world soccer, and UEFA, the body that governs European soccer, are especially obsessed with trying to stamp out racism. During the European Championships, the captains of each team read a prepared statement before the games denouncing racism, there were signs surrounding the field commanding fans to say no to racism. I suppose the fact that they had to go to such great lengths to denounce racism is probably good evidence of its existence. I think that there's a lot of this depends from country to country, but I think over time the presence of these players from abroad will help stamp out racism. It'll take a long time because you got places like Spain and Italy, which are as globalized and have as many African and Latin American players playing in their leagues as any place in the world, yet racism is still a fact of life in their soccer stadiums.
So, Frank, we only have about a minute left, but I'm going to put you on the spot because I can't resist and because I need to sound smart when I go to a party and I want to act like I know what I'm talking about. So give me the 411 on, are there any teams that you think are going to surprise us? Are the teams that we should keep our eye on, the sleepers?
Yeah, well, it's hard
the ones
to
watch.
You know, with 2 years to go to the tournament, and so much changes over the course of 2 years in soccer, it's hard to say, and you don't even know who's going to qualify. Right now, Brazil, who's always the favorite to win the World Cup, isn't even in one of the top four slots in the South America Federation. So, you know, if they were to continue playing like they're playing now, they wouldn't even qualify for the World Cup. England, which didn't qualify for the European Championship, could be a really strong team going into the next World Cup. They just hired an Italian coach named Fabio Capello, who's one of the best coaches in the world. So I would be a fool to make any prediction at this early stage.
Okay, what about South Africa, which is hosting the World Cup in 2010? How are they doing?
Well, they have some strong players, but they don't have a particularly strong program, so they're never going to do that well in a World Cup, although host nations always tend to do better than you expect.
That's funny, the host effect.
Yeah, yeah, okay. They got the hometown advantage.
All right, we have to leave it there. Frank, thanks so much.
Frank Foer
is author of How Soccer Explains the World, An Unlikely Theory of Globalization. He joined us from his office in Washington. Thanks so much.
Take care.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Today, we celebrate a birthday, not of a person, but an organization. Alpha Kappa Alpha, or AKA, is the country's oldest African-American Greek letter sorority. The organization was founded in January 1908. That's when a young woman named Ethel Hedgman gathered 15 of her classmates and friends at Howard University's campus here in Washington to form an association of women students. At first, the group's purpose was to offer mutual support to those student members. But now the group reaches far beyond that one campus with efforts to address issues important to young women and girls across the country and around the world. This week, AKA members are gathering here in Washington to celebrate their 100th anniversary. Joining me in the studio to talk about the organization's legacy and future is Barbara McKenzie. She is the international president of the organization. Also with us is Andrea Mile. She's a member of AKA's chapter in Okinawa, Japan. Thank you both for coming and congratulations.
Thank you.
I want to start by saying that Greek letter organizations play a very big role in the lives of many students at some campuses, at HBCUs and others, but some people know very little about them. So I wanted to start by asking each of you why you wanted to join and what it means to you to be a member of AKA. Barbara?
I think the first context is that we have to view the predominantly African-American fraternal organizations, and there are nine of us, no different than we view any other institution in our African-American communities. They were designed at the turn of the century, which was when we began to form, that one generation from slavery, most African-Americans in this country were not going to college. In fact, very few Americans were going to college. And so in concert with what was expected of them, these privileged students expected to not only educate themselves, but uplift the community.
So why did you want to join, and what does it mean to you?
Alpha Kappa Alpha for me, and I joined in college as an undergraduate. In fact, I was a freshman when I became a member of this organization. It always represented the opportunity to join what I have always been taught was a common good. Life is about, as I've been taught, and one value I hold dearly, life is about giving as you receive. And Alpha Kappa Alpha is a vessel by which I can do that.
Andrea, what about you? What does it mean to you to belong to AKA, and why did you want to join?
Well, my beginnings with Alpha Kappa Alpha started with role models with my grandmother and my mother. So there's three generations of Alpha Kappa Alpha women within my family. Growing up, they were role models to me, and through my observations and through those that were also members of their various chapters who also adopted me and mentored me as I was growing up to be a young woman, just allowed me to see what being a woman, an African American woman living in this time could be and how they could influence the community, a very diverse community, myself coming originally from Hawaii, and seeing that there's many people that have needs.
Ms. McKenzie, you pointed out that at the time this organization was founded and the others that followed afterwards, that circumstances for African Americans very different in this country. How do you think the organization's mission has changed over the years, if indeed it has changed over the years?
I don't think it has, because even today, 100 years later, we still have African Americans who have not fully participated in this freedom, as it were, in America, the greatest country on earth. So in that context, our mission hasn't changed. I think that to hold steadfast to that mission for 10 decades, five generations, is a testament to the relevance of the mission today. What we know is that the challenge probably is even greater, because no longer are we bound by the shores of America, but we live in a global society. So our work is certainly not done.
Andrea, I wanted to ask, how does the organization function overseas? I think that you think of the sorority as being so rooted in the African-American experience and living overseas. How does it work overseas?
The organization is in nine other countries. Japan, Germany, Korea, just to mention a few of them, and the Caribbean. I can't leave that out. But in each of those environments, we have civilians and military personnel who are serving their country. And with that, there is a need to mentor women, to inspire our young men. And that need is there. And it just so happens that we have members who travel either in uniform or in other capacities, like myself as a civilian living overseas and being able to support the organization and to continue its mission. Barbara had mentioned it being very global. How wonderful for us to be able to take our organization to places like Japan.
Barbara, talk to me about that. What do you think that you get from being in a sorority that you don't necessarily experience in other service organizations? Or because there are other groups that do good work, you know. What do you think you get from the sorority experience that's special, that's distinct?
Well, I think what makes us different is very simply, we are family by choice, not by purpose, but by choice. And it's a connection that we all get and we are committed to for life. It certainly is embedded under the foundation of faith and hope and love, which are values that are very much Christian values. But all of us are not Christians, so I don't want to try and share that. But what we are humanists. And that is that we stand for all humans to develop to their full potential. Our focus happens to be in particular on women.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're speaking with Barbara McKenzie and Andrea Mile about the centennial of the oldest African-American Greek letter sorority, Alpha Kappa Alpha. Ms. McKenzie, you were saying that the every president comes up with a theme. You titled yours The Heart of ESP, an Extraordinary Service Program, ESP being an acronym for Economic Sisterhood Partnerships. Why did you choose this theme?
I chose them because at the core of this theme for me in this centennial year, it became very important for every single member to participate. So ESP also means every soror, which is a Greek word for sister, participates. Economics and entrepreneurship is the theme of the day. It is certainly something that helps connect us in a global universe. The S is service, but it also stands for sisterhood. And the P is for partnerships. So you must be strategic in who you align your values with and your mission with, so that through partnerships, we're able to do a much better job. And as an institution of 100 years, we know that through a network of 1,000 chapters that are all over the world.
What are some of the activities, though, that your members are involved in? Andrea, do you want to tell me a story about some of the kinds of activities you guys get involved in overseas and in your chapter?
Surely. We will adopt or mentor students usually in the middle school and high school, and to teach them how to be good stewards with their money, how you can grow money, how you can take that allowance and make it grow and what it can look like in the future. Then moving a little bit further, we have health things that need to be discussed. So we bring our family and our communities in to talk about some of the issues that are prevalent in that particular community, whether it be diabetes or it be premarital sex, and to really start to prime the group to be able to talk freely about some of these things so that they are aware of what's happening around them, not only personally, but also on a broader scale.
I wanted to talk about the diversity of the membership. Are there non-Black members?
Absolutely, have always been since we were founded.
Why do you think most people... I don't know if people know that. Why do you think people don't know that? And is that ever challenging for the members, given the particular history that African Americans have in this country?
We've always been a diverse membership. Our first honorary member was Jane Addams, who was a white woman in Chicago in the early 20th century. One of our probably most noted honorary members, too, who happened to be white, was First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt in the 40s. We relate to people as humans based on values. Alpha Kappa Alpha is no different than other institutions. We were born out of the need of having our race improve itself and creating a sanctuary for that race to do that. In this case, it was African-American college-trained women. But nowhere in that did we do it because we wanted to be exclusive.
Andrea, you want to comment on that?
Well, I just think based on myself, and that's all I can speak from, is that people tend to look at the world, look at what they're surrounding, and they're drawn to that which best suits where they're headed in life and what they're interested in or what they're interested in becoming. And those that are and find Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority Incorporated in alignment with what they do, regardless of skin color, come.
Speaking of skin color, I think this is the kind of issue that's surfaced in some black movies, for example, over the years. You know what I mean? Some sort of the popular culture over the years. On the one hand, people think of the Greek Letter Sorority as being a very important source of support for students, and then even after, as they make their way through the professional world. On the other hand, some have, in the past at least, experienced these groups as elitist and sort of exclusionary. Can you speak to that? Do you still get that? Do people still ask you about that? Have you ever experienced that? And what do you say to that?
Each of us are the product of our experiences. It's more about what you are becoming than it is about where you've come from. So I'm not saying it doesn't exist. I also would tend to think that if you were to look at any of the organizations in their history and you look to see, well, where did people come from in this country? And you deal with slavery and everything else, you could get into the whole complexion issue and have your answer. I think that's much more reality check than it is
what,
an
was
elitist
there,
statement.
Was there a paper bag test?
What? Alpha Kappa Alpha?
Yeah.
Absolutely not. I mean, have you taken a look at some of our members? Then I guess I'd ask you the question. Did they pass a paper bag test?
Well, that's now, though.
Well, now
back in the day.
Now we've got members of that same complexion that have been members for 50 years.
As my grandmother.
Really?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
What I will say, if there was a bias, it was on intelligence. They sought the best.
Best students.
They looked for those that were looking to become something great in order to uplift a race. Because they did not, you would not find across any chapters, members who had under B averages of scholastic achievement from the beginning. Our founders were 16 women who went to Howard as undergraduates. However, 9 of them left Howard and went to Columbia in New York for graduate work in the early 1900s. No one got in Columbia being a mediocre student. So that was the issue. But if you take a look at our founders, they range the hue of complexion from white to very dark. And our first president was a lady who had come from a state. She was an orphan. She had no parents. But it was her intellect and her tennis skills that got her a scholarship at Howard. But she became the first president. And she was not someone that I would say passed a paper bag test.
Nellie Quander.
No.
What was her? The Lucy first president?
Lucy Snow.
Lucy Snow.
Flo
the first president.
Was our first president. Nellie Quander was our first national president. She was a lady that went back to Howard when there was another group that was looking to change the mission and purpose about 5 years after the organization was founded. And so she was the catalyst that actually created the national institution. See, until 1913, Alpha Kappa Alpha was just a little chapter on Howard's campus. And in 1913, we were incorporated to be a national body and grow. And Nellie Quander was the visionary for that.
You've devoted a lot of your time to the organization over the years. I mean, tremendous amount of time since college to the organization. Why do you think it means so much to you?
Because of the fruits of his labors. I don't know all the children that we've touched. Don't need to know them. I don't know all the lives we've saved. Don't need to know that either. Just need to know that we do. And when I think of 200,000 women in 975 chapters around the globe who are that committed to do that, then it makes me know that this world is a better place and that this institution I cherish had something to do with it.
Andrea, do you, you're what, third generation?
Yes.
Alpha Kappa Alpha. Do you have a daughter?
No, not yet.
Not yet? will she be allowed to come home if perhaps she pledges Delta or, for example?
I just don't know that that would happen. And it wouldn't be something that necessarily I would discourage by any means.
But, you know, the chapter has a strict policy against hazing and physical intimidation. I have to emphasize that.
It wouldn't be something that I would discourage. But I just believe that she would be drawn to the organization. And if she did not become a member, that she would certainly have a heart for the organization.
And Ms. McKenzie, I don't know if it's a special honor for you to be president during the organization's centennial. 100 years of history behind you. What do you hope for? What do you envision for the next 100 years?
It's an honor. It's a privilege. It's a humbling experience. And it is at times an overwhelming challenge. But what you hope for is no different than what has happened. What could you hope for? That the diversity that has always been with our institution remain a viable part, which it will. But I say remain in the context of it growing. Because if you look around the world, you will find a great diversity among women as to in other countries where these women need to be empowered and need to experience and understand life and quality of life as we do here. And if we do that, those women are not going to look like the African-American women we've had for this first 100 years. They're going to look very different. At the same time, we haven't solved all our problems here either. And so we cannot abandon it as if we've reached 100 years of success and so all is well, because all is not well. And so it's now being able to do this in a major way on more than one front, so to speak.
Barbara McKenzie is the international president of Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority, Incorporated. We were also joined by Andrea Mile. She is a member of AKA's chapter in Okinawa, Japan. I thank you both so much for joining us. Congratulations and have a wonderful convention.
Thank you so very
for
much,
having
Michelle.
Us. Yes.
Remember, with Tell Me More, the conversation never ends. Earlier, I asked my two guests what they got from their sorority experience that they would not have gotten in any other service organization. And now I want to ask you, are you a member of a Greek letter fraternity or a sorority? Or do you belong to a different type of public service organization, a church, a neighborhood group? Do you believe these groups perform a vital public service? Do you need to belong to a group to help you give back to your community? To tell us more about what you're doing and to read about how other listeners are making a difference, please go to the Tell Me More webpage at npr.org and blog it out. You can also call our comment line at 202-842-3522. That number again, 202-842-3522. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.